It's an honor to introduce to you our speaker today, and I don't think I took a knee when I was begging him to come, but it was close. I caught him on the day that the working group had him testify, and he was all over national television, and I know that he rearranged his schedule to be with us. Through personal and professional commitments, he made the trip. After months of a national campaign, it's hard to imagine that Governor Mitt Romney needs an introduction, but I think he deserves one. He came on the national scene in 2002. At that time, the state of Utah was hosting the Winter Olympics. Salt Lake City faced a financial crisis that threatened to sink the games before the torch could be lit. So they turned to a successful businessman, largely unknown on the national stage, by the name of Mitt, who eliminated a $379 million deficit, organized the help of more than 23,000 volunteers, reinvigorated the local and national spirit in support of the Olympics, and made America proud to host the Games. From that work project in Utah, he made his way back to his home in Massachusetts, successfully ran for governor. Still trying to figure out how you won that one, garnering 50% of the vote. And he ran as a Republican in Massachusetts. He brought a new tone to the state. Wasted no time getting the job done. By the end of his term, Governor Romney had successfully closed and inherited $3 billion budget shortfall, oversaw a period of strong economic expansion, and passed sweeping reforms in education and health. No small feat for a man who served only one term as governor. But Governor Romney, and it's a state not friendly to Republican ideals, I don't need to tell you all in this room, but he held the line, advocating Republican principles, proven principles, eliminated debt, instituted pro-growth policies, and limited the reach of government. And it was those principles that Governor Romney took to the campaign trail in 2007 and 2008 as he sought the nomination of our party for President of the United States. And while ultimately unsuccessful in his bid, he was, as we all know, a forceful advocate for the ideals that we cherish. Strong conservative ideals of a national defense, a federal government of limited powers, and American citizenry enjoying the freedoms given to them by their creator. For his defense of these principles, irrespective of the outcome of the primaries, Mitt Romney, we are grateful to you, and America is grateful. Governor Romney's come a long way since 1984. In that year, he founded a highly successful company, consulting firm known as Bain Capital. From Bain Capital to the Winter Olympics to the governorship to running for president, he's shown his dedication to this country in private and in public ways. And my colleagues in the room would be glad to know, now as the honorary chairman of the Free and Strong America PAC, he is continuing that tradition. That organization is committed to, quote, advancing conservative social and fiscal foreign policies that are essential to our nation's freedom, close quote. No doubt this organization and Governor Romney will play an indelible and significant role in the future of the Republican Party, and as we've been saying throughout this retreat, in the future of the United States of America. It is my high honor to recognize our speaker for lunch, Governor Mitt Romney.
Very generous. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. I am among friends, and I appreciate that very warm welcome. And by the way, thank you for the vote this week. It resonated across the country. I got calls after your vote from family and friends, and they felt exactly as I did. We are proud of the Republican Party, proud of you and what you did. Thank you so very much. Thank you, Congressman Pence, for that introduction, and thank you to each of the members here in leadership. Appreciate the chance to be with you. It is good to be in a room full of Republicans who actually won in November. And you, of course, can be proud of your success, and you may want to remind the president from time to time of this. You also won. And therefore have a seat at that table. Of course, after after my campaign was over, Ann and I wanted to get as far away from things as we could, and we went to Beijing. That's about as far as you can get. Went to the Olympic Games over there. One day we went to the women's beach volleyball event, one of my favorites. And Ann says I had to go. She wanted to show me some inferior female physiques. But anyway, some people there in the audience recognized me and began taking my picture from across the arena. And I noticed more and more cameras going up, people pointing our way. I said to Ann, sit up straight. They're taking our picture. She goes like this. And I turn around. There's Kobe Bryant sitting behind me. So I know where I stand. Now, a few months have passed since the election. It's enough time for us to consider the outcome and also to consider the future course for our party. I want to make it clear that I am very optimistic about our prospects. Our ideas are good. Our agenda is right for building a strong America. And your action this week showed that we have the kind of leadership that the country needs at a critical time. I've been asked a lot in some interviews in the last several days what the course is going to be for the Republican Party, how we're going to turn the party around. And I respond by saying I'm not so concerned about the party as I'm about the country. And in fact, they are highly related, as you know. In my view, the best way for us to advance the prospects of our party are for us to advance the prospects of our country. That's what the American people have expect of us, and that's, of course, what we expect of ourselves. Now, this is a time of hardship and uncertainty for millions of our fellow citizens. The question is, whose ideals will turn things around? And at such a moment, it's our job to offer the kind of clear answers and proven solutions and resolute leadership that'll get the country going again. Now, the new president and the congressional majority seem to be having a hard time doing just that. After all, they have a lot of campaign rhetoric they have to make good on, and they got a lot of special interests they have to pay back. As the opposition party, we're entirely free to do what's right for the country. There's a certain advantage, of course, to that kind of freedom, and I propose that we take full advantage of it. That begins with a clear analysis of what's needed to get the economy going again. I know you know a lot about that, given what's been going on the last few weeks, but I can't help but talk about it some more. There are some who predict that we're almost out of the woods and we shouldn't worry about it. I think that's wishful thinking, even though, of course, they point to the calendar of prior recessions. I think this is different than that for a lot of reasons. First of all, Americans have lost about $11 trillion in net worth, an unthinkable number. That translates into almost $400 billion a year less in consumer spending. And then there's another factor that doesn't get very much attention, and that's the pool of investment capital. That pool of investment capital is the money that's used to start businesses, to grow businesses, to add capital expenditures, to add the working capital necessary to hire people. That pool of investment capital has taken a hit in excess of $1 trillion. It's in the trillions. And what that means is, unless we address that, it could continue to be a damper on the growth of our economy for a long, long time to come. And given, therefore, these extraordinary circumstances, I'm convinced that a stimulus is needed. So why not just spend and borrow with reckless abandon? Well, because we're in a very delicate situation that could easily make things worse. It's very delicate right now. Why is that? Well, we borrowed an extraordinary amount of money from the world. And if we add to that debt excessively, or if we spend the money we borrow in a foolish way, we could make things much worse than they are now. We could precipitate a worldwide crisis in confidence in America, a crisis that would let people think that we're going to have an economic meltdown, that our currency is not valued, that there would be rampant inflation, runaway inflation. And as a result of that, we could see hyperinflation that could wipe out the savings of American families and at the same time devastate the middle class. We're on an economic tightrope, and that's why it's so important that we exercise extreme care and caution and deliberation as we consider the stimulus bill. So far, the Democratic leadership hasn't shown a great deal of promise for doing just that. They passed $355 billion of infrastructure spending, 60% of which won't be spent until after 2010. Billions of dollars being spent for electronic medical records. I believe in those. I just don't think they're going to create jobs anytime in the near future. Even worse are the liberal payoffs they stuffed in there, $50 billion for the National Endowment for the Arts, hundreds of billions of dollars to states for STD prevention. And until your loud protest took out some particularly onerous things, there were some extraordinary things in there, like the $200 million for the National Mall. It would grow grass, it just wouldn't grow jobs. I recognize that this country is in a setting where it is extraordinarily fragile, and we're on this economic tightrope where the wrong step could have us fall off on either side. Now, it's still early in the administration of Barack Obama, and like everyone who loves the country, I want to see him adopt correct principles and then do the right thing for the country and be successful as a president. He still has a chance to step in and insist that members of his own party restrain their spending and devote it to those things which are absolutely essential. It is his job to set the priorities. I hope for America's sake that he knows that the job of the chief executive is not just to vote present, that the job of the chief executive is not to let others run the show, that the job of the chief executive is to say yes to some things and to say no to others. A true stimulus package, one that recognizes the productivity and genius of the American people, could lift the economy out of recession. Experience shows us what it should look like. Let me offer a couple of thoughts. First, there are two ways the government could put money back into the hands of the economy. One is by spending more, and the other is by taxing less. And it's been proven that taxing less is the most effective if you want to stimulate the economy. Even Christine Romer, the president's chairman-elect for the Council of Economic Advisors, in her research shows that putting money into tax cuts has twice the impact of putting money into new infrastructure spending when you're talking about boosting the economy. Second issue, any new spending has to be strictly limited to projects that are absolutely essential. How do you define essential? Well, a good rule is that the project would have been a legitimate project in the first place and it would have been carried out anyway. The only thing you're doing differently is bringing it forward so that it creates jobs now. And let me just note in that regard that would take out a lot of things that are in the bill that the House passed. A lot of things would be taken out, and some things should be put back in, or should be put in. And one of them relates to the military. Our equipment has been shot up. Our troops are over there in harm's way. There are men and women who will be killed today. And the idea that we're putting $50 million into the National Endowment for the Arts and not putting money into giving our troops the equipment they need is simply unthinkable. Third, rebate checks to citizens and to businesses may feel good. They're rebate checks, but they are not tax cuts. They sold the idea that a check in the mail is a tax cut. It may be nice to receive, but it's not a tax cut. The media bought that. They're wrong. It's just a rebate. And we found last year that by sending out rebate checks to people, you get a boost in disposable income. You just don't get a boost in consumption. Why is that? Well, people use that money to pay off debt or to put it into savings, and businesses, of course, even if they see a bump in consumption, are not about to go out and add equipment and hire more people to meet the needs that are produced by what is obviously a small blip and a temporary blip. By the way, you know that by proposing what they call tax breaks, as the Democrats have, they're admitting that by giving relief to families and businesses, you help the economy. Why can't they just simply shed their ideological bias and give the American people the kind of permanent, broad-based tax relief that even they know would reduce the suffering in this country? Fourth, if we're going to spend more and tax less to get this economy moving, we're going to have to make another commitment as well. And that is that as soon as this economy recovers, we will regain control over the federal budget and above all, over entitlement spending. This is more important than I think most people recognize. There's a real danger that the trillions of dollars of additional budget or additional borrowing to plug the budget gap, as well as to fund this stimulus, that these additional trillions of dollars will cause investors worldwide to get concerned that the dollar is not going to be worth as much in the future as it is today. They may fear hyperinflation. If they fear hyperinflation and start pulling their support out of our out of our currency, we could find our economy in a lot worse condition than it's in today. And that's why it's so critical that we show the world that we are committed to reining in excessive spending and borrowing. Fifth, we have to address the enormous losses in the capital investment pool, that risk capital pool I spoke about. And very clearly, the most significant way you can get that done is to send a clear message that you're not going to raise taxes on investment and capital gains. You know the answer. The tax cuts of 2003 and 2001 should be extended permanently, or at least temporarily. And finally, let's exercise some restraint in the size of the stimulus as well. Without it, you're going to see it continue to grow day after day after day as people pork up this bill further and further. Last year, with the economy heading into severe waters, I proposed an economic stimulus bill. My figure was $233 billion. The Washington Post was outraged, and I quote what they said. Quote, Romney's plan is way too big. So what do they have to say now? I'm afraid they've caught a very bad case of liberal laryngitis, and I'm afraid it's spreading around the country these days. We need to make sure that we rein in the size of spending. And the final analysis, of course, we're the party that knows that it's the private sector, businesses and entrepreneurs, large and small, that are going to create the millions of jobs that are needed to get this economy going again. The invisible hand of the market is always faster and more sure than the heavy hand of government. The difference between us and the Democrats, by the way, is this. They want to stimulate the government, and we want to stimulate the economy. Now, let's not forget, of course, that government does have an obligation to address some of the abuses we've seen in the markets in these last few years, particularly in the mortgage finance sector and in the mortgage guarantee sector. But when markets work as they should, and when they're effectively and efficiently regulated, free markets have and will create jobs and prosperity. As Republicans, we must remain the confident choice of limited government and free enterprise. And those principles are going to come into conflict with another issue that's coming down the pike very soon, and that's health care. Just to offer a couple of thoughts. In my view, we should be first to propose a Republican plan to get every American insured, one based on market dynamics, free choice, and personal responsibility. I happen to think that the plan we put together in Massachusetts is a good place to start, but wherever we take it, let's simply not react to what the Democrats put forward. They will inevitably put forward a bill that will create vast new entitlements and bureaucracy, burdening the people and threatening the economy down the road. That's unthinkable. Americans will be looking for an alternative. We ought to give it to them and give it to them first. Let's also defend the right of workers against coercion and intimidation. The working people of this country should be able to unionize the way their fathers and mothers did, with free choice and a secret ballot. The Democrats' plan to take away those rights of the American worker would result in economic calamity right now and down the road as well. More than that, it's an insult to the common sense of the working people of this country. We're going to defend the freedom of workers and the rights of labor. Isn't it interesting which party it is that stands up for workers and which party jumps up for union bosses? Ours is the party of freedom and free enterprise. And we're also the party of life. I know that I'm not alone in wondering why this administration in its very first hours directed that taxpayer dollars are going to be used to help fund international organizations that promote and provide abortions. Is that really what the world needs now? More abortions funded by American taxpayers? In our party, we don't have perfect agreement on the life issue. But with this administration that answers to the most extreme wing of the abortion lobby, our duty as a party is clear, and that is we should be a voice of moderation and compassion. And even if the administration will say nothing on behalf of the child waiting to be born, we must take the side of life. The administration has gained favor on another topic, favor with the liberal commentators, and that's on the topic of the war on terror. The president pledged what he calls reform in the treatment of detainees. He's also pledged that he's going to close Guantanamo. I wonder if he noticed that two of the people that were on the Al-Qaeda tape last week were formerly detainees at Guantanamo. I wonder if he's thought about what he's going to do with terrorists that we capture, people who are fighting and killing Americans. Where's he going to put them? Send them back to the countries where they take them and release them to fight again and kill Americans again? Or will he put them in our own prisons where they can infect our own criminal population? There may be more steps that he takes that are akin to these, and they'll, of course, receive the predictable plaudits from certain professors and editorial boards and the like, who have no responsibility whatsoever for protecting American lives. The Washington Post last week, by the way, had an interesting headline in announcing the steps that Barack Obama had taken in this regard. It said this: Bush's war on terror comes to a sudden end. Hope the president recognizes that the terrorists are still fighting and killing Americans and planning to fight and kill Americans. I hope this president recognizes those things. And I hope we all recognize that when it comes to defending America, our party will speak confidently. We have no greater duty than a vigilant defense of the United States of America. You know, our party has seen some setbacks before. They've never defined us. For our party, I believe that this moment is going to be remembered as the time when we demonstrated the strength of our convictions, as the time when we defended the foundations of America's enterprise, prosperity, its safety and security, and its freedom and liberty. We'll be tested over the coming years. It's not for us to choose what tests we see, but we are, of course, entirely free to choose how we're going to respond to those tests. We'll face them as you did this last week, and we'll face them as Republicans have done in the past in our finest moments, with the clarity and confidence of those who put their country first. That's the work you've undertaken as the Republican members of the 111th Congress. You gather in smaller numbers than you did last year, but you also have the resolve to lead America to a better future. A comeback for our nation and for our party started with you this week, with the courageous vote you took. America needs that brand of character. America needs this commitment to doing what's right. America needs the conviction to principle, the very principles that this nation was founded upon. You're up to the challenge. It's going to be a real fight. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be fun. I envy you for the fight, but I want you to know that it can be a lot of us right there cheering along and doing everything we can to make sure you're successful. Thank you so very much. Now, I'm told we get a chance to have some questions and attempts at answers. And what do we have, 3 minutes?
We have 15 minutes.
We have 15 minutes. And my guess is that there may be a couple there. I've asked the congressman to pick from among the folks that are here. So please raise a hand and offer a suggestion.
We have microphones, portable mics staff has on either end of the room. I can't see through the lights. If you want to slip your hand into the air, question or comment is welcome to the governor. Randy Neckerbauer.
Here comes the mic.
Governor, thank you for coming. And we in the next few days, we think we're going to see this administration bring what they're calling the bad bank plan to the forefront to continue to try to do something with some of our financial markets. Obviously, you've been in the financial world for a while. Could you give us some reflections on your thoughts on that plan, whether you like it or don't like it? If you like it, you know, how it should be structured. If you don't like it, you know, what are some alternatives, ideas that we might need to consider?
Thank you. That was a tough vote, and I recognize that as well. Another tough vote on TARP. And if anybody thought it was a bailout of Wall Street, they should have voted no if they thought it was a bailout of Wall Street, because America doesn't need a bailout of Wall Street, but America does need to make sure that our currency doesn't collapse, that our financial system doesn't collapse, that we would see a cascading of collapses of banks. And therefore, I was supportive of the decision to put in place this this facility for our government to be able to stand in and preserve the financial system. I see those monies, as your leader has spoken about seeing them, specifically dedicated to protecting the financial system, keeping it in business. I do not see it as a fund to help the auto industry, even though I think that's an important task and should be properly structured and done effectively, but that's not what TARP was designed to do. I don't think it's out there to help all sorts of individuals and businesses that have challenges and problems. It was not designed to be a safety pool. It was designed instead to make sure that our currency is worth something, that our financial system is in place, that people know that their savings they put in the bank, they can get back. I mean, these are the kinds of threats and worries that existed before that was passed. And so I have not seen what the administration is putting together. I have confidence, a good deal of confidence in Tim Geithner. I'm hopeful that what he puts together will make sense. I'm fearful that the efforts to take care of friends and to play favorites and to take care of special projects and to take care of lobbyists and family members will infect this legislation. And if it does, you got to vote no again. I mean, I think you have to lay down the gauntlet on principle time and again. Even if you like something overall and say it's important, if they make it ugly, if they make it un-American, you just got to say, we can't be part of that. And in this case, if it's a bill that's specifically focused towards keeping financial institutions in business, great. If it's not, it's unacceptable. And there are a number of ways of helping financial institutions, of course. One, you can invest directly into the financial institution itself, making a stock investment. That's not anti-American. I know there's some that say, that sounds like we're nationalizing the bank. Well, if we get non-voting shares, preferred stock, for instance, or if we distribute the shares to the public, that certainly wouldn't be a government takeover of that institution. And for that matter, there are going to be some sovereign debt funds from other countries that are planning on buying big stakes in banks. We might as well make sure that we have stakes in banks. And so, one, you can invest directly in the bank. Two, the thing I proposed a long time ago, and I think Secretary Geithner was suggesting recently, is a bad bank. I called it a cooperative, where banks could contribute some of their troubled assets, their troubled loans. This cooperative would then go out and get as much as they could for each of those and then return the money to the bank, keeping a share of the proceeds for themselves. That would compensate this cooperative that I proposed some time ago. That works. That's worked before. I think it could work in the future. So some quick thoughts. It's an important topic. I wouldn't walk away from TARP as long as it's done with the integrity of the purpose for which it was set out in the first place.
Cliff Stearns from Florida.
Governor Romney, thank you very much for coming and for all you're doing for the Republican Party. When we see all the stimulus package, there's a lot of concerns of what we as Republicans should talk about in terms of regulatory reform. We see what happened with Madoff and the Security Exchange Commission, even back to 1992 knew about it, and all through the years nothing happened. And you see what happens with the Federal Reserve, you see that the oversight of the banks, and all this is out there, and yet there's no one suggesting that we need some regulatory reform in the financial markets, and I was curious if you think there should be or should not be.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to reform and update financial market regulations regularly. Improve, update, eliminate the ineffective, put in place the more effective. Because our economy changes so dramatically, financial instruments change so much, financial institutions change so much, you got to change regulation. You know, I personally think that we as a party have put ourselves in a bit of a corner in people's minds in some respects, because we talk about being anti-regulation. What we mean by that is anti-excessive, burdensome regulation that weighs down the economy and kills jobs. But of course we believe in effective regulation and law. I mean, if you thought you were going to invest in something and your competitor could steal it without paying you and you couldn't defend against that theft, why you wouldn't invest? I mean, we believe in law and regulation. That's essential for an economy to work. But you believe in effective and efficient regulation, cutting out the ineffective. We got to, I think maybe Frank Luntz, who's here, can help us choose better words than just sounding like we're anti-regulation. Yeah, in the financial services industry, find to regulate where it's effective and efficient. And I guess that's a term of art. You got to look piece by piece. There will always, of course, be bad guys like Madoff who steal. I mean, that, I don't know any regulation that can keep that from happening, or law for that matter. You can make it illegal so that you can go after them, as we are now. But it's going to, those kinds of things will unfortunately happen. But finding them before they become severe and substantial, as Madoff's was, is something we should do. In my view, the greatest failure of regulation in the last 50 years, and maybe longer, was the failure to effectively oversee and regulate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That was blocked by the Democrats. And it is the height of irony for me to watch the TV and see certain congressmen standing up and pontificate about regulation in the markets when they were sitting in oversight of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and did nothing. It is unacceptable.
Don Manzullo, Illinois.
Governor, I went through two Nash Ramblers, so I'm in the older set of up here. In all of the stimulus bills that have come up, there seems to be very little recognition of restarting the means of production and manufacturing. I mean, everybody is buying into trickle-down economics. You put the money in from the top, you try to fix the banks, try to keep the big three going. The problem is, 2 years ago we sold 17 million new cars. Last year we sold 10 million. That's $175 billion was directly sucked out of the economy if cars average about $25,000 a piece. Several of us in here, including Doug Lamborn, have come up with plans to give, for example, a $5,000 tax credit if you buy a brand new car. Then you could drive off in a wonderful Chrysler Patriot, proudly built in the 16th Congressional District, for $15,000 as opposed to $20,000, and restart the supply chain going. It's not that hard. It's $5 billion for every 1 million cars sold. For $75 billion, you get 15 million cars sold. But nobody is talking about that. And it backs up farther than just 10% of the economy. There's a fellow in St. Charles by the name of Ron Bullock, runs a place called Bison Gear. He's the chairman of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. He put in two new lines last year, beating the pants off the Mexicans and the Chinese on the production of small electric motors. Those motors go into the assembly lines. I mean, we can't do anything unless we try to concentrate on restarting manufacturing. I know you have that background. And you know what? I am sorry these banks got stuck with that dang debt. GMAC got in debt or their heels on mortgage debt. They've got bad debt on automobile loans. And now they've become a regular bank that's going head-to-head with the small community banks. I think we're going in totally the wrong direction on this entire bailout. Your plans to restart manufacturing, because I know it's extremely important for the complete recovery.
I fully agree that manufacturing must be a major portion of our economy. I do not believe we should stand by idly as it disintegrates and disappears. I know there are renowned economists who vehemently disagree, who believe that manufacturing, if it could be done cheaper or better in China and other places, should go there, and that we should move to the higher value-added areas, and we should be designing new products, and we should be marketing products. But what they ignore, in my view, having spent a lot of years in the business world, in manufacturing and non-manufacturing settings, is that there is an inexorable link between making something and learning how to develop new things. That there's a link between the science, between the innovation, the engineering, and the production. And if we let all the production go, then ultimately all of the science and the innovation is going to follow. This nation must continue to lead in manufacturing, and it's unacceptable for us to say goodbye to the aircraft industry or to the computer manufacturing industry or to the automotive industry. At the same time, writing a check to Detroit to keep doing what it's been doing in the past is not the answer. Doing that will allow the UAW to continue with the wage and benefits and the work rules that will ultimately kill that industry. It scares the life out of me. I love cars. I love Detroit. I love the automobile industry. I want to see it thrive. We can compete. There's no reason we can't make cars or anything else in this country every bit as efficiently as the Japanese and Koreans and Germans make cars in this country. We can do it as well as they can. And we're going to have to do that and make sure that we make the kind of changes, and it's going to take a serious session with the UAW and with others to have reality and to make ourselves competitive. We got some work to do in that regard. And with regards to manufacturing, one of the things I'd mention is there's a real problem with the embedded taxes we have in our products. It makes our products more expensive here and more expensive around the world compared to that of our competitors. That's something we have got to change. There's a lot of work on the manufacturing front, but we can't just sit back and say, gee, we're going to let it go where it goes, because they'll take it offshore, and the consequences for us would be unthinkable.
Scott Garrett, I think I saw Scott starting to leave the room. He was in the queue. Fred Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute.
Oh, good. Hey, Fred.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for letting a voice from the peanut gallery ask a question. Governor, thank you for your remarks, and thank you for everything you've done for the nation. I'd like to ask you a few specific questions about the idea of a defense stimulus, which I think is incredibly important. First of all, if you could flesh out a little bit more what you think is needed and what you think that would consist of. Second of all, if you could talk a little bit about how you think a Republican Party that wants to advocate adding a defense portion to a stimulus package that it fundamentally disagrees with in many respects, how can the politics of that be made to work? And lastly, one of the things that's always driven me crazy about this debate is I feel like we've lost the argument with the American people by not having it about the role that defense spending actually plays in the economy. And I think that this whole $3 trillion war nonsense, which has gotten out there as a way of telling the American people that there's a one-to-one guns versus butter trade-off, is one of the things that is makes it very difficult to pursue the spending that is urgently necessary for our armed forces, but that actually, I think, also can help the American economy. So I wonder if you could comment on those things.
You know, I think you, in your question, you commented awfully well, Fred, and so I don't know that I'm going to adjust that dramatically. The point is that our industrial military complex that we were taught to fear in the 1950s is actually a source of extraordinary technology and economy and growth for our nation, and we're in competition with other nations around the world. We've been competing with Russia. They're tough technologically, but they have been in the doldrums in a manufacturing and industrial sense since the Yeltsin years, although they're regrouping in a very significant way. China has not been the kind of player in this environment that they will be. We're going to face, we really don't compete now with China in making the most modern fighter jets or bombers and so forth, or even ships, but that's coming. They're going to develop the technology, and they will be as tough in making those things as they are in making textiles and other products where they've become so dominant. And so we're going to have to be serious about supporting our manufacturing and innovation centers in defense, because it's so critical to the defense of our country, but also to the economy of our country. Secondly, with regards to our men and women in uniform and what they need, I'm not the expert you are as to the specific equipment, but I can tell you, having been in Afghanistan and Iraq, and having spoken with the leaders of the National Guard of my state, I see how many helicopters have been shot down and have been badly damaged. I see how many personnel carriers and other pieces of equipment are gone, and they're gone by virtue of being used. I look at the proportion of our defense budget, which has gone towards operations and maintenance, particularly maintenance, and it's gone down, 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 down. And new purchases of equipment has gone down. Personnel costs have gone up. You can't do that forever. We've been living off the borrowed equipment from, if you will, the peace dividend following the collapse of the Soviet Union. We had a lot of equipment. We've been using that up. It's time for us to replace that equipment, to modernize it. And for our soldiers to have to be fighting with old equipment, and in many cases with equipment that's no longer usable, is unthinkable at a time when this country is saying, hey, look, we got to spend some money. Some of that money can be spent in defense procurement across a wide array of contractors, and that money can be spent immediately. If those of you haven't seen Marty Feldstein's article on this, it was yesterday, I think. I'm not sure it was in the New York Times, where he lays out the kind of defense spending that may be necessary, but also the fact it can be spent quickly. Instead of an infrastructure project that takes years, we've got companies making equipment. Just tell them we want more, and they'll be able to boost employment, and that will boost our economy short-term, protect our troops, and defend ourselves against the long-term interests of China as it tries to grow into this very critical market. Thanks, Fred. Our time is up, but I just want to tell you what a privilege it is to be here with you. I respect what you're doing. I know how tough it's going to be. I can't imagine what it's like to slog it out as you have to in the minority. And of course, to fly home every week back and forth to see your families, it's an enormous sacrifice you make. And I, as a citizen, I appreciate the sacrifice you're making. You are needed. Don't run off. Stay together with the kind of courage that you showed this last week, and you'll see yourselves in the majority again soon. I will be working to help in that regard, as will a lot of other Republicans. We're going to be battling for what you're going to be doing in 10 and making sure that you have a stronger voice, because America needs it. This is a critical time. I don't know that I can remember a time during my lifetime that I've seen so many extraordinary challenges. I mean, I know we're all talking about the economy. That's the first and foremost thing in our mind. But gosh, there's a war going on. There are people killing Americans. Iranians are supporting efforts around the world to kill Americans. We're making progress in Iran, in Iraq, not in Iran. We're making progress in Iraq. We're making progress in Afghanistan. We're making progress around the world in helping turn back the tide of this extraordinary threat. At the same time, we face extraordinary challenges economically, in part because we painted ourselves in a corner by having borrowed so much and spent so much already that we have a hard time providing the stimulus that the economy needs right now. And then there are other challenges, our healthcare challenge, our education system that's falling so far behind, our entitlement challenge that promises to overwhelm us down the road. And perhaps the challenge I'm most concerned about is just the attitudes and culture of our citizenry, our belief in hard work and enterprise, our faith in family. These are concerns, and you're at the center of it. And I want to congratulate you on the fight that you're carrying out, the fight that you will carry out, and let you know there are millions and millions of people cheering you on. Thanks so much.
I've got a presentation for you.
Governor, thank you for coming. And along with everyone else here, I express my heartfelt thanks for your time and the grit and determination that you bring to this cause. I want to share with you, as I have all of our colleagues, a copy of the greatest movie ever made, the movie Hoosiers, and wish you Godspeed. Thank you all.